Okay, next. So we were having trouble with our participation in these workshops at the library, so we went out on the street. And this was working on the MAPS project. We just set up on the street and got involvement of people that way. Next. And that led to also taking the project back out into the community, setting up the museum for a week. Okay, next. So then I started thinking, well, how about if I just go out on site and work with whoever is there and with the community around a specific site, which I said, well, it's got to be Salter Grove because I'm really curious and I really love that place. And then also around the same time, I was encouraged to apply for a New Works grant from the Rhode Island Foundation. And that really would gave me an opportunity to do my own work, which I hadn't done since my kids were born, and they're like 11, almost 12 now. So it was like, yes, go for doing my work in a site that I love, with a community that I know, and I know some of the history. And fortunately, I got the grant, and then also got some money from RISCA, and was off and running for a year and a half of really kind of focusing on this place. Okay, next. So part of my process was I got to go to the park. I had to go to the park often to sketch. I kept journal, and I did a lot of writing, which was wonderful to do because I do like to write if it's creative writing. Writing grants and all that stuff, yes. I don't know. But that's where I depend on Michael E. Carroll. Next. And then this is another couple of pages from my journals. Next. And then I also took photographs. Next. Next.
Sorry?
That's fine.
Okay, next. Can I just keep going?
Yeah. And I really got to know some of the regulars, as Paul knows some of the regulars. And these guys were great. Rick was often somewhat inebriated, but I really like Rick. He'd always come with his dog, and we'd chat. And last time I saw him, which was after the show went up, and he received a card in the mail and stuff. He was excited to go into his car in his glove box, and he pulled out a photograph he had taken that was absolutely stunning. And he had just taken it with a disposable camera, and it was of the swans, and it was very sort of light colors and grays in the swans. And then over on one side was his brown, reddish-brown dog about to leap into where the swans were, but the composition was beautiful, and it was just, he had blown it up and given it to his mother. He was like so excited about this photograph, and then he was excited to show it to me. And I had given him a photograph of he and Bill, and he had blown that up and given it to his mother. So it was just so heartwarming. And Bill at one point too was out of work and living in his van in the park. And by the end of the summer, he had moved on and gotten a job. And he was out there playing his guitar. Okay. Another way I involved community was, it was initiated actually by Tricia Wolf, my neighbor, to do a cleanup. We were talking about it. And then she called DEM and got the bags and gloves and things. And we had a cleanup at the park. And I asked everybody to pick a treasure. As they were doing their cleanup, and here you'll see these are the treasures that they collected, and those are the things that are on the outer walls of the exhibit. Okay, next. And then I also asked people to photograph, because it gave me an opportunity to see Salter Grove through other people's eyes, and that was really important in terms of opening my vision up to this place. If I could see it through their eyes and through photography, one can do that. So this is one of my youngest photographers, and he was photographing a bottle that was and the minnows that were in the water. Okay, next. And then this photograph, there was a few of them by this, I'm sure, the same photographer, because it was a similar view. This really struck me, and this really inspired this grouping of prints here, which is of Rock Island at high tide. I thought, my God, this is exactly what I haven't seen. I feel it here. I feel the sense of space and light. And it's what people talk about. They come here for just the space and the quiet. And this photograph really embodied that for me. And I said, yes, this is it. I've got to use this in my piece. So this really was influential to me. But I wouldn't have seen it without this person's photograph. Okay, next. And this is, I took of Rock Island at high tide. Okay, next. And then the stories. People's stories were really an important resource for me in doing this project. And Nancy Brown Garcia is, as I said before, she was, you know, seminal in me being interested in this place. And this is a poem that she wrote and gave to me about Salter Grove. Next. And this is a Xerox of a photograph that she tore out of her journal and gave to me after she had visited me in my studio and saw what I was working on. And she felt that I needed to have that, and I'm grateful. And that is part of the woods panel, which is one of the first ones as you walk in. Okay, next. And Ed Greer, bless him. He, 80 years old, he took us out to Rock Island, climbed the jetty, climbed all those rocks because he wanted to show us, next, these carvings, this 19th century graffiti that's carved in the rocks out there on Rock Island. Next. And here you can see the date. The last one, I'm not sure about the date. It almost looks like 1705, but this one is 1830. Which was fabulous to see. He also showed us where the wild asparagus was and things to go out there. Okay, next. And then this man, Mark Seepy, is somebody that I just met because he was feeding the gulls and I wanted to photograph those birds flying in because it'd be great. So I talked with him and found out that he started telling me his story. His wife had only died a couple of years before, but he remembered, you know, he always loved to come there because they loved to come there. And he had some photographs of her back in, I think it was the 40s. You all will be able to tell me the year of the car in the next photograph. And this is one of the photographs of his wife. So dates, Henry? Do you recognize that car, or Michael, or Bill? What?
36,
35, 4?
It's before World War II.
I don't know.
35?
Not sure, but the 30s, mid-30s,
the 30s,
maybe.
Okay.
35.
Has a rumble seat, right? We're showing see the handle there.
34.
So, you know, I mean, people had told me how this was Lover's Lane and things. But it was wonderful to get this very specific, heartfelt story from this man who I had to really pursue because he moved from his house. There was a for sale sign, and I had no way of getting hold of him. So I wrote a letter to the realtor, and I said, please forward this on to Mark Seepy because I wanted to get together with him and see his photographs. And eventually, I got a phone call, and he said, I'll meet you at Salter Grove. I have the photographs. And it was just like, yes! So all of these things are such gifts. I just felt so fortunate. And also, today, couples go out there, and I see, you know, the men photographing the women, you know, next to the backdrop of the water. I mean, it's a romantic spot. Okay, next. And there we go.
Who's that young man?
Youth.
Henry. Is that you?
Forever grateful
35 years ago.
To Henry Brown.
I remember that day.
All of his information. And
I've changed some.
A little. No,
except the hat. The hat's just the same.
Right. So some of you may recognize this image of Henry in the panels also. Okay, next. And then Bill Ruggieri. I mean, Peter Michelson came to a talk that Michael and I did for PVA and said, you've got to meet my neighbor, Bill Ruggieri. And I'm so grateful to Peter because Bill has been such a passionate supporter of this project. And he, too, had me climbing around on rocks and finding graffiti from the 20th century on the mainland. And he also invited me over to his house and had cleaned it up and everything and sat me down with two shoeboxes full of snapshots, family snapshots, mm-hmm. which to me, those are much more valuable and interesting and heartfelt than postcard pictures of Salter Grove. Because they really, I think, capture more intimate moments, and that's what I'm more interested in as an artist. And some of you may recognize the top one, the girl in the boat, which is part of these panels, the outline. And then this is Rock Island back here, and some of you might be able to see the houses that once were out there. Okay, next. And then Psalm.
Wow.
Psalm, the fisherman's psalm.
How did you do that? Oh, my Lord.
Look at that, huh?
Yeah. 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 If you listen hard on the listen
yeah,
hard
we interviewed
on the CD.
Some, so he's on the tape.
On
and
the
he will
CD,
be
he's talking about this particular fish,
right,
whom he refers to as probably a grandfather.
And some, we were just about to sit down to dinner, and the doorbell rings, and I open it, and there's Sam. What's he doing there? And he says, Holly, you've got to come see this fish that I just caught at Salter Grove. It's like, okay. And so he opens up the back of his car, and there's this huge fish in there. And I said, Sam, I have to take a photograph of you with your fish.
Oh,
and so I ran and got my camera, and so Sam held it up. And it was as big as my kids were at that point.
They were bigger.
Magic.
Yeah. So, and one of the first times that Sam and I really connected was he was walking back from fishing in Salter Grove on the causeway, and I was taking my kids out there to climb around.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the first time we really connected, though we had known each other. So, okay, next. Now this, some of you may have noticed this image in the woods piece. I had been carrying around this image for a few years. I had cut it out of the newspaper, and it's of a sculpture by an artist that I just felt very connected to that image. I thought it was very powerful. And when I was thinking about Salter Grove, I thought, yes, I've got to use that image in Salter Grove, because to me, I think of it as a fetal ancestor. Mm. And that's what this project was about, really kind of digging into the land and really trying to show some of the layers of the history of this place, and that it does have a huge long past. Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, I feel badly, I don't know the name of the sculptor that did it. And one of the hardest things for me, doing all this research was fabulous, and meeting all of you and hearing the stories, the hardest thing was getting to work in the studio. Mm-hmm. And I just want to definitely thank Lucia O'Reilly and Alyssa Wood for supporting me and, you know, just go for it. Dive in and start working. Next. So this is, back. So this is me in the studio. And many of these were done small on a piece of plexiglass with ink. And then they were later blown up. Next. And that's, again, working on them. And then I had the panels hung in my studio. After they were blown up, they had been scanned. The small prints had been scanned by a friend and then blown up digitally and printed on the paper that you see that's a tie paper. It's made out of hemp. And I chose it because it felt like the textures of Salter Grove. And I had to piece it together because it only came in one size. But when I saw them blown up and I had them suspended and the light coming through, I didn't like them, because they were very washed out. And it was like, God, all this work. I really didn't like them. And then I put my hand behind one and saw how the light came through the paper. And it was like, wow, there's something here I need to work with. Next. And I had also had to figure out what I was going to do with the backs of these things, because I knew that you all would be walking through and you'd see both sides of the paper. So I had to figure out what to do. And so I was on the bus going to Boston, or going to New York, that's my sanctuary time, is on the bus. And it just came to me, silhouettes. Mm-hmm. And so I started scribbling onto, you know, my paper bag that I had my coffee in, and just put it into my journal. And I loved it how I put it right on top of that landscape of Rock Island at high tide, which I showed you the photograph of. And it just all clicked. Okay, I've got to put these silhouettes of these figures with this landscape, and they're going to be large. And I'm also grateful to Jessica Rosner, another artist friend, who said, just keep it simple, think white on white, and it was a great suggestion. Okay, next. Mm-hmm. And then in the final hour, when I had to come up with a figure that had been with me for a long time, I'd done a sketch of it, that was inspired by something that Henry wrote in his book, which was about the colonial history and James Rhodes. It said that Squire Rhodes, as he was called, liked to sit and watch the progress of his merchant vessels returning from the West Indies as they sailed up the bay to anchor in Patuxent Cove. And so that struck me when I had read it, and I had to... Lucia said, you've got to get somebody to sit for you, because my drawing was the idea, but it was kind of awkward. So I thought, Ed. And I called him up, and he said, sure, come on over. So I said, Ed, you got a hat? He put a hat on, and we moved some furniture around, and he sat for me. And some of you might remember that the outline of the large male figure sitting on the rocking chair, and that was it. So, to bring this to a close, I found that the project had a life of its own. I needed to listen to the clues I was getting from the stories, from the people I happened to meet, the photos I took, the things I observed and remembered. The process of pulling it together, figuring out the imagery and sequence, was led by the making of the images. I never saw it all together until it was hung here. It took a lot of faith in the process to complete, and I always had the site, Salter Grove, to go back to. And almost every time I went there, I found another piece, another treasure. And by the end of the summer, I usually ran into someone I knew. And I just thank you all for being part of it. And I want to leave you with one last quote from educator David Sobel, which he says in his book, Children's Special Places. Feeling a sense of place in adulthood heads us to a commitment to preserve the integrity of the communities we live in. Developing this sense of place depends on the previous bonding of the child to the nearby natural world in middle childhood. The sense of place is born in childhood's special places. So, thank you. And right now, I would like to invite a few people in the audience to come sit up here, and we'll kind of, I guess, do a... Michael's talking first.
Yeah.
Okay.
You want to take my place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll
you
take
can
your
become
place.
The folklorist.
Okay.
I'm Michael Bell, and I'm a folklorist. I'm looking for the 10 steps to recovery as a folklorist. I mean, actually, really, it is much easier to be a historian than a folklorist, as Henry Brown will tell you. Because no one ever asked a historian, you know, what is history? Or what does a historian do? Everybody seems to know what history is and what a historian does. As a folklorist, I always have to explain myself. And I feel like I spent the first 10 of my 26 years here in Rhode Island explaining myself to funding agencies so that they would eventually fund projects that I wanted to do, because they were all like, Well, what does a folklorist do, and what is folklore? One of the problems with the term folklore is that it's connected in everyday language with things that aren't true. Oh, that's just folklore, meaning that's not true, that's false. Things that are outdated, things that are survivals from the past that have no meaning now, they're detached from their context. Things that are only passed along unwittingly by people who don't think about what they're doing. So that's the kind of impetus that I'm up against as a folklorist. And believe me, that's not what we folklorists think about when we think of folklore. I mean, trust me, I would not devote my entire professional life to studying things that were false and outmoded and survivals from the past and meaningless. I just wouldn't do that. So, for a folklorist, folklore is, one folklorist said, artistic communication in small groups. I mean, that's very different from the idea of something that's outmoded and meaningless and false. Another folklorist has said, folklore is only folklore when it's performed. Which is an interesting idea. Folklore is expressive culture. Well, what sets it apart from other artistic forms? Number one, it's traditional, meaning it's passed down through time from person to person, usually by word of mouth in face-to-face situations. And that gives it some stability. It gives it an anchor in the past. It brings the past into the present. And then the present can become part of the future if we keep that process going. But on the other side of the coin, which is very interesting, is that to really be part of folklore, it has to exist in variation. Meaning if I've only heard one version of this story, or whatever it is that I'm experiencing, if it's only one version, it's probably not part of folklore. It's something else. Now that's where historians and folklorists start to part company. Because someone like Henry Brown will hear different versions of the same thing from the past and go, wait a minute, you know, one of these has got to be wrong, right? Me, I get excited because I'm thinking, okay, I'm in the realm of folklore because I'm listening to oral tradition that's been passed down through different people over time. And so during that process, it takes on different forms and different, and becomes, it's unique every time it's expressed. Every time it's performed, it's unique. Now, who are we talking about who's doing all this performing? People that went to RISD and got degrees as folk artists? No, talking about you. Talking about Bill Richieri, Kim Greenberg, Henry Brown, Sam. Talking about all of us, because we are all folk artists. And I think, in a sense, that's where a project like this and the projects that I do and the projects I've done with Holly, that's where the kernel lies that ties us together. That we realize that we're all, in some senses, artists. Now, many of us aren't really aware of the art that we perform every day. We don't think much about it. I mean, think about conversation. Think about the conversations you have every day with people. What do we talk about? Mostly we talk about our personal experiences. So we're narrating our past. We're reformulating experiences we've had, and we're putting them into a story form that people can relate to and understand. And usually if I say something about what happened to me yesterday, someone will share a story. Maybe that stimulated a memory of something similar or an incident that happened to that person some time ago, and that story will come out. And you can see this chain process of interaction going on. And people are performing. Now, we're not aware of it. We're doing this very much sort of unconsciously. It's just what we've learned. And we've learned from a very young age to do this. We've learned from the time we were separate from our mother, and we realized that, wow, I can go in here and eat cat food. And we hear a voice from the other room going, what are you doing in there? Well, right away we're under pressure to narrate, to tell a story, you know. Do we tell the truth? Nothing. And this process increases as we get older. You come home from school, and your parents say, well, what happened to you today? Well, one of my kids would say nothing. And the other one would start from the time she left the door to get on the school bus, and then go through, and you were going like, well, summarize. So, you know, between those two extremes, we learn through social pressure, starting with our parents, how to tell stories. You know, what are the elements of the story? What can we leave out and what can we put in? And eventually, if we're aware of the process that's going on, we start to think, well, cool, I could make that a better story, you know, if I add this little thing that really didn't quite happen, but, you know, it's... And that brings up history versus folklore again. There's a difference between fact and truth. Okay? Historians are interested in facts. I understand that. I appreciate that. I welcome that. If I study a legend, which is a story that seems to be based on fact, then I have to go and look for those facts to see, did this really happen or not? Because I want to know that. Just because I'm a folklorist doesn't mean history is irrelevant. It's really the background to the folklore. Mm-hmm. It brings it into focus. But there's also truth, which is like cultural truth. So when somebody who's a preservationist asked me once, I won't mention names. Was it Robert? It definitely was not Robert. I was doing some oral histories with some Native Americans, and he says, why are you wasting your time doing that? Because you know those stories aren't true. And I said, well, maybe they're factual and maybe they're not. But the fact is that the people who tell these stories believe that they're true. So number one, what I'm getting to understand by them sharing their stories with me are their beliefs and their attitudes and their worldview and their philosophy. And that's important because that helps us understand why they do what they do. If we don't know that, then we don't know them. And we can't understand them, we can't relate to them, really. If we just look at facts as facts. So I'm interested in that kind of truth. Truthiness. Not exactly. Truthiness. Well, when I started doing the project with Holly, you know, I was aware of Salter Grove and the stories, and it was very exciting to me to get the stories. I wanted to understand people's experiences with that place. And so I was asking them not only about the who, what, where, when, and why, but I also wanted to get their feelings and emotions and respect and whatever else they had associated with the place. And so those aren't really stories per se, but they come out in how people talk about the place. Some people are pretty open and expressive about it. Paul's written some very lovely poems about Salter Grove. So they express directly his feelings about that place. Most of us don't have that kind of talent to do that. So it's something that comes out between the lines in the story really often, quite often. So when Holly asked me to take part in the project, she said, well, you can do what you do as a folklorist, only you've got the freedom to be, you know, an artist here. Mm-hmm. You can take the sound and you can make a sound collage of all the stories you've gathered and pieces of the stories, mm-hmm, and put them together so that they're playing at the same time people are walking through the exhibit. And at first, it was a challenge. The idea was kind of daunting. Because usually I'll collect stories from people, I'll record them, and then I'll interpret them the way a folklorist would. And I'll use that story, and then I'll comment on things about the story, to contextualize it as a folklorist would, to make it understandable, you know, from the point of view of being a folklorist. What is its meaning? What is its function? What's its structure? How does it relate to history? Things like that. But this, I thought, wow, I'm just really free, I can just go crazy. But you know, when you listen to what I put together, it's not really artistic. Because I was constrained by the structure of narrative. And I had to confront that directly when I was picking these stories apart that all you people helped share with me and trying to put them together in different ways. And the fact is that, number one, narrative stories are linear. So they have a beginning, and they go through a process, and they usually have an ending. But the fact is it's basically a single strand going along. Usually that sequence is chronological. People talk about things in kind of the order that they actually happened. And so right away, just narrative itself is starting to constrain what I can do. I mean, I can't take 3 words from somebody and put 2 words from somebody, you know? It wouldn't be a story anymore, would it? And I can't put multiple stories on top of each other. Because stories tend to be single-stranded in the sense that you can only experience at one time one narrative going on. If you start to hear several at the same time, it's going to be confusing. It won't make sense. It'll be annoying, really. It's like being in a room and having, you know, 7 or 8 people all talking at once on different topics. That can be very annoying. I realize we're all getting into multitasking, but I think that's asking us, you know, way too much. So in a sense, the constraints of the narrative form itself really put constraints on what I could do with the CD that I put together. I guess you could say that's the negative side. It limited my freedom of choice. On the positive side, it provided a grounding framework for the visuals that Holly put together. Because she could be a lot more creative and expressive, I think, than I could be, in the sense that she could have layers, visual layers, you know, things on the backside coming through, and collages, and different textures. It was very difficult to try to get that with people telling their stories. So in a sense, what you hear, I suppose, is what kind of is the thread that ties together all of these different images and panels. I think it's very difficult when you're in here going through the exhibit with the voices on the speakers. I think it's difficult to kind of listen and at the same time experience the exhibit itself. I don't know. Maybe I could get some feedback on that later. I don't know how well that worked. I wanted to say a little bit about the process of interviewing people. We did several sorts of interviews. One thing we did were group interviews that we've been calling story circles. And that is, we just announced that we're going to have this story circle, usually at the boathouse, on a certain topic. And we invite people who are interested to come and bring artifacts, photographs, memorabilia to share. And people just show up and start talking about whatever topic it is and showing what they have. And it's a wonderful way to get people talking and sharing stories. Sometimes you get multi-stories going on at the same time, which is kind of difficult. And those situations are also difficult to record. So here I am with my little mini disc recorder and my little microphone going around trying to get the best recording I can. But the fact is, I want the context, I want the texture of the event, I want the ambiance. So when we went out to Salter Grove and talked to people, yeah, there's wind noise, but there's also birds and the sound of the waves, things like that. So I traded the pristine sounds that I could get from a sound studio for the kind of context and ambiance that really exists in nature. It can be annoying when you hear it on a CD, because when you're in the environment itself, you tend to block that out. That's noise, and you focus on what it is that's important that you're hearing. You really can't do that so much when you hear it, like on a CD or a tape recording. That noise comes in, and it can be bothersome. We also interviewed people individually in private homes, too, to get more in-depth stories from one individual. So we got both. We got the individuals, we got the group interplay. And it was my job to take hours and hours and hours of all of these recordings and go through it and put together, basically I put together a 65-minute CD that repeats over and over as the exhibit is up and running. I think I ended up with 100 sound bites that I selected. And I put each one on a separate piece of paper, and I just kept shuffling them around in piles. And what happened is basically I sorted them loosely by theme, and then within each of the themes, they're sort of chronological. So, not very artistic at all, really, is it? It's just more like imitating reality. Without adding a great deal to it. So in some ways I'm pleased with it, in other ways I feel that I could have done something a little more jazzy. I don't know.
Well, we'll do more.
but I don't really have much more to add to on my part of the project, except that I'm very grateful and happy that all of the people who participated did so. For me, it was a wonderful experience. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as you can see, I mean, it's just been great working with Michael, and I hope that we will do more projects. I want to introduce you to Paul Merluzzo. Paul was sort of this magic person, another magic person at Salter Grove. I had put up a sign, I think maybe about the cleanup at Salter Grove, and which was just a flyer. And I came back to sort of visit Salter Grove like a couple days later or something, and there was some piece of paper, you know, like in the back of the flyer. I thought that was curious. I parked my car, went over, and I took. And it was a poem that somebody had written and left for me. It was like another treasure. And I was just so, so surprised and so warmed by that. And I don't know if it was that day or the next day I came back I heard somebody call my name. And I looked around. And there was Paul and a friend of Paul's, and he said, "Are you Holly?" And I said, "Yes." And he said that he had left the poem, and I was so. That's how I met Paul. And Paul goes to Salter Grove often, and he knows the regulars there, and he's been great, kind of. I don't want to say connection, but just a kindred spirit. Let's say that. He teaches public speaking and writing at Johnson & Wales University and is a poet, a photographer, and as I said, a daily visitor to Salter Grove, which is a place that he incorporates into both his poetry and his photography. And he's also author of Artificial Illumination and Spirit and Letter. And he is going to be our moderator today to kind of make sure we're all in line, so to speak. Yeah,
in sync.
But first, I would like him to share his connection to Salter Grove and to the project.
Hi, I'm Paul, and I'm sort of like a documenter too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's see. I have a little. Holly had asked me. I did the questions. And so I thought I'd just throw this out to the audience before I started with my connection. What I'd like you to do is when the various speakers come up here, mull the questions over what they're saying. And I think it's important not only to discuss the plays, but also this installation as well. And so there are just like three questions. Do you have a renewed connection to Salter Grove because of this installation? I mean, for all of us, it's ongoing. New appreciation of it, seen through somebody else's eyes. What impact does this exhibition of visual and audio work have on you? I disagree with you about what you said about your participation in this. Because the first time I came here, I couldn't make it the first week. I came the second Sunday. And I was the only one in here, aside from a lady at the desk. And I'm walking around. I forgot I had recorded the poems. And I'm walking around looking at the wonderful scrolls, and all of a sudden I hear my voice in the air. And I'm going, oh, I said out loud, thank God I was the only one here. I said, hey, that's me. And she started laughing. You know? And I listened. And it was touching, and it was nice. And I said, I really have to learn to read my poetry better. But I liked it, and I loved the sound bits, and I loved the birds. And I didn't find them intrusive at all. Not at all. I like the screen. Well, anyway, we can go to that a little bit later. But and what do you take away from your experience after experiencing this installation itself? I should tell you my connection to the place. I grew up in Western Cranston. I left in 78. I returned. I moved to Los Angeles, which is not on this planet. It was a wonderful experience. And when I moved back here in 95, after being gone for 17 years, I had to discover Rhode Island. I was now middle-aged, and most Rhode Islanders don't even visit the small places within the state. They just don't. And so I decided to discover Rhode Island. I had remembered Patuxent Village. So that's why I came down to this area. And then I said, where does this go? So I followed. I was on Narragansett Boulevard. And I said, what's that? I mean, it's the ocean, like right there. It's not. I know it's the river now, but I thought it was the ocean. I said, what's that? So I went in. Now, 95 was a transitional year for me. I was only here for a few months because I was planning to go move to Italy for about 3 months or so, which I did. And so I just loved the place. There was a sense of space and peace. And to me, that little area breathes. Not only because of the changing wind and the water, the landscape is always changing. It's not flat. It's not really manicured except every Wednesday. It's overgrown, you know. And when I was there in 95, it wasn't the park we know today. That road, the Lover's Lane part, went all the way back, and you could drive your car in and all. I thought that was weird. And, you know, City Park, not really kept up by the city. This is sort of cool. And then I liked it, and I decided I had to teach myself Italian 2 weeks before I left for Italy. So what I did was I went to the library, I got two sets of Italian tapes, and every day for the first week of the 2 weeks, every time I was conscious, there would be Italian in the background. I didn't listen to it, it was just there. And I would come to Salter, and I'd have a little thing around, and I'd be listening, I'd be writing, I'd be reading, and the Italians were talking in the back of my head. And then, the week before I left for Italy, I plopped myself down on one of the picnic tables with the tape, but I actually went through the Italian lessons. And of course, that's when I got to meet the regulars. You know, what are you doing? Because there I am at a picnic table all alone, speaking into a tape recorder, Italian, you know. So I got to learn them, and then I left. I left, and when I came back, it was wintertime. It was 3 months later in wintertime, and I decided I would go see. It's a completely different place in winter. It has its own personality. It's great. And then, of course, life being what it is, they asked me to be the director of the English Language Institute in Florida, Johnson and Wales. So I left Rhode Island again in 99. And I was gone for 5 years. And then in 2004, I came back again. And where do I go? To Salter Grove. It's a special place. And I know several special places. But this one, for some reason, is like the sleeping dog. It's like the sleeping giant. It breathes. It has a presence. Do not disturb it. You know, please, do not disturb it. And so every time I'd come back, so since 2004, I've been going there regularly. And since I now no longer teach in the summer, because I'm teaching something completely different, this past summer I was there almost every day, and got to know Bill and Rick and everybody, the neighbors walking their dogs, everybody has their particular schedule, just like the tides. I go there and I just marvel. I marvel at the landscape, the seascape. You would think stays the same. It's changing all the time. And I do a walking meditation when I go there. I say hi to the guys after I get out of my car, and I walk. a particular, the edges of the place, all the way up and back. And every step is a deliberate thing, and it's done in silence. And there are certain plants that I go to that I just have become aware of them as presences. And I go visit certain little trees that are growing, you know, I can't wait till spring to see what survives. You know, and I get to view particular plants. I have learned to call cardinals. I mimic their whistle, and the cardinals come and look at me like, what? You know? So, and there's all of this stuff going on there. So after I do my little walking meditation, and I go talk to the guys, I go for a walk down by the breakwater, whatever, I don't go out there anymore. I'm afraid I'm going to fall and break a hip, you know? But I should do that, because I saw some interesting things and heard a couple of interesting stories tonight. I've never seen those carved rocks. I got to go out there. So, anyway, that's my connection to it. And I started photographing it again. I used to be a photographer for many years in my private and professional life before I was an instructor. And when I saw you put up the thing and I read the cleanup thing and I thought, oh, that's when I included the poem, the first of the poems. And then, I don't know, it was like, it was a focal point for me. It gave me a reference. I can do more with this. So I wrote like three more. When it was gone, the next day I think I went back and it was gone. And I thought, gee, I wonder if she got it. I wonder if the wind blew it. I had no clue. And then I didn't hear from her, because I think I put some information. I thought, she didn't get it. Or maybe she wasn't interested in it at all. And I thought, that's so strange. And then eventually we met. Who else? I mean, you see her walking around with their chalks and everything. Of course it's got to be Holly, right? So that's when I went up to her, and that's when we started this relationship. Because we all have a relationship with this piece of land. And we have a relationship with this land on many levels. You know, this is a deeply inwooded land. You know, this is the land that lives inside us, like our breath. This is an important place for all of us. And for people who are not here. And for those people who are not here anymore. And for those birds, you know. And about the installation, I think you coming up with this display for the scrolls is wonderful. I love how it disappears and then how it becomes itself again, just like the grove does with trees and leaves. And how when people walk by them, they move like trees and leaves. And how when you have the lighting and they're translucent and you look through them, like I was telling Gary, Pentimento in painting, where the hidden image down below has been painted over, but the ghost of it still comes through. And those images are just like our memories. The memories don't come in chronological order. They just pop up. That's what this is like for me. That's what this is like for me. And all those specific little details on the shelves. It's a wonderful, wonderful exhibit for a very special, tiny little place. I hope it never gets too manicured. I hope it stays rustic and all of that stuff. I wish they would stop breaking bottles there. Oh, but that's part of it, you know? That's part of it. That place is like a rite of passage.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, I think that's all I have to say. And perhaps some of the photographs that I've taken here and there will be put on the website. Yeah. I've enjoyed it. I've come to all three panel discussions, and I've been photographing bits and pieces. So, and working on them a little bit and sending them to you. So I've really, really enjoyed this particular series. Thank you. You want me to introduce a panelist? Do you think we should take a break for 5 minutes? We've been sitting for at least an hour. I don't know about you, but my hips. I gotta get up.
5 minutes. Yeah, take a break.
5 minutes, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. For about 10 minutes. Hello, we're about to begin. So please take your seats. We have living history.
We're fossils.
I'm just going to take a chair. We have three people who will be speaking. I'm the timekeeper. We have about 10 minutes. I'll just say time. You can slowly wrap it up. I'll be introducing them individually rather than a group introduction. First to speak will be Bill Ruggieri. Bill lives at Country Club Drive in a house that abuts Salter Grove. He grew up visiting his aunt who lived in that house, which he inherited when she passed away. Now retired, Bill has a large collection of photographs and memories of Salter Grove. In his own words, it's a very special place. He can see it from his windows, and he continues to visit it daily. Bill Ruggieri.
Hello. I'd like to first thank Holly and Michael and Henry for making this whole event very, very, very interesting. I better grab my water down. I got to have my water down. Anyway, yes, I do live next to Salter's Grove, and I'm very fortunate that I've had many, many, many years in that area. I can tell you some of the experiences, good and bad, that I've had down there. But and I'd like to welcome some of the living Warwick Downs people, Margie and Jack Butler. Of course, Henry's been all through that area many, 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 many times. But to start, I guess my grandfather bought that house in the 20s. And I realize now that the houses that were down in Warwick Downs area were probably just summer houses way back then. They weren't all year round houses. They were just summer cottages. And I guess my first introduction to Warwick Downs area was when it was a crowded, very crowded beach. I was probably at Wyman School at the time, and World War II hadn't started yet. And I used to walk down with my mother through the fields, and there weren't many houses between my house and the beach area. I got to really enjoy the people that lived down there in that area, and we certainly made good use of the island, Rock Island, and we did a lot of boating. Something was brought up tonight that before the breakwater went in, we had a more lovely natural spot. There was a lighthouse right out straight where we used to row our boats and go out to the lighthouse, and the Coast Guard would be there. Excuse me. I've been in a lot of dusty places lately in my trade. But anyway, so we'd go out to the lighthouse, and we'd stay there and have a soda. They'd give us a soda, and there were just so many things to do. I told Holly and Michael about some of the experiences that we had. One was like jumping ice cakes, which I saw a picture of in a yearbook just this past week of what jumping ice cakes is. And it's when the bay froze over and then melted and everything broke apart. You would just go out there and take your life into your own hands and jump from one ice cake to another. Other things that we did there was frost fishing. In the wintertime, we'd have our spear, we'd have our boots, and we'd our flashlight, and we'd go out there at night. Mr. Greer isn't here, but right off where he lives, just in that area, and we'd spot the fish and spear them, and that was a lot of fun. We'd sit on the beach at night sometimes at Warwick Downs, and we could look across at Crescent Park and not only hear the roller coaster, but we could watch the fireworks every 4th of July, and that was always interesting. We also would go down to the beach at night and catch crabs and start a fire, throw the crabs in the boiling water, and really enjoy that. That was really, really wonderful experience. The beach itself had a lifeguard, and it had a raft that we used to swim out to. Some of us could swim. One time, one fellow was going to bring me out, just hold me around my neck, he said. And he got about halfway, says, let go. I wasn't about to let go. He was getting tired. But anyway, he made it to the raft. And thank God I hung on tight. But speaking of the carvings in the rocks, I knew a man, his name was Pop Harrigan, and his name is written in the rocks, and I realized that he was alive when Abraham Lincoln was president. He was 90 years old back in 1940, so I thought that was kind of interesting to realize that after all these years, that he went way back, and that's a fact, isn't it, Jack, huh? And they had duck hunting down there, and we had the picnics. The first picture that was on the wall there with the where the rock was, the Indian rock. We used to have St. Peter's picnics there. We had races, and I think we used to take the hot ice, was it, and throw it in the water and watch it steam up. And it was just loads of memories down there. There was someone that used to have outdoor movies. The kids would pay a few cents, and it was outdoors, and I guess it was one of those 16-millimeter cameras that they used to show movies with. And other things that we might have done down there was card playing, and always go over to the beach house, and in the evening when she emptied all her ice cream containers, she'd pass the containers out to the young people that were in the area, and we'd scoop out whatever we could. I guess I could go on and on and on, but I'm very fortunate to live right next door to Salters Grove, and I've been wanting to maybe light up the island maybe someday, maybe with the help of some artists. My son wants to do that. I did light up that lonely tree, lodge tree that's right where we go sliding, and I've gone sliding every year down there. And
what's that called? Suicide?
maybe. But yeah, the lodge tree that's has a nice shape to it had gotten lit up with lots of lights this year. It wasn't easy, but we did it anyway. So I guess my time is probably up. Yeah, Henry.
Question. I think you told me you did frost fishing down at Gaspard Water Downs. Frost
yes, frost fishing.
Does anyone know what frost fish are? I don't think most people here know what frost fish are.
What frost fish are?
Yeah, what they are.
Henry, they look similar to an eel, right, Jack? They were bony, but it was the sport of catching the fish, and it was just kind of a lot of fun to do that. But I don't know that it was great eating. It was nothing like that fish that I saw on the picture tonight. That was great. I'm trying to find out exactly where he caught that fish. I think he's going to tell us though. I don't think he's going to tell us.
Isn't it still polluted?
Yes.
One day we decided to go out in a rowboat. No, we had an outboard too. We rowed out till we could stop the. I had borrowed an outboard motor from my dad, and we got out into the channel. And all of a sudden, the back of the boat was gone, and of course, that's where the outboard motor went to.
Oh,
the boat
God.
Didn't sink, but I was, you know, petrified at what was going to happen to me when I got back home. But nothing happened. It was just one of those accidents. But yeah, many memories down there. Okay, I thank you, and thank you, Michael and Holly, again.
Our next speaker is Kim Greenberg. She moved to the neighborhood next to Salter Grove as a 9-year-old child more than 40 years ago. Coming from heavily urbanized South Providence, yes, Kim was immediately captured by the peaceful surroundings of Salter Grove. Over the years, the park has been a haven for her, my first place to feel safe. She said, my affinity for coming down here changed throughout my years, but it has always been a safe place to come to. Now she lives up the street with her own family, and she and her children have developed new rituals. I'd love to hear about them. New rituals for engaging Salter Grove. Kim.
Hello, everyone. And I want to thank publicly Michael and Holly for blessing me with this journey and honoring me to be part of it. Yes, I did move from Providence to...
Yes.
I loved how it was so eloquently written. Thank you. Yes, I moved from South Providence when I was 8 years old to right across, two streets up from the opening to the Warwick Downs. And when I moved here, I said, oh my God, I'm in the country! I mean, I just couldn't believe the difference from 10 minutes from where I was to where I live, in fact, today. As Paul stated, I found a safe place there. When I was growing up, we lived in a three-tenement home, and there was a lot of dysfunction going on in the home, and the neighborhood was just starting to change. And so to move to the place of space and breath and get out of that three-tenement home where there was so much dysfunction. Not that the dysfunction I moved to was any better, but it was a little more peaceful and spatial than what I had come from. And throughout the years, the Downs became so different for me. I did Lover's Haven. I did drug addiction. I did a lot of crazy things down at the Downs. I remember I also came into the neighborhood when the rebirth was happening. Narragansett Village condominiums were being put in, and the break walls were just going up again. So I feel very privileged also to have moved in when the rebirth was taking place. I also right now live on Landon Road, which is just directly across from the park, the Downs. And I live next to the only dwelling on my street that is originally from years ago. So I feel kind of honored in that way as well. Throughout my childhood, there was a lot of fun that happened there. And then there was a lot of chaoticness. I was a product of the 70s, and we went to Pilgrim, which is up at the top of the Parkway. And we had an annual day called Scrape Day at the Breakers. And that was who could scrape yourself up the most. So it has, and then they had for Gatsby Days, they had the, on Friday nights, they had the fireworks. That was another crazy thing that went on. I did have my first kiss there, and I've had many a tear there. I've had many of revelations there, and I have been in recovery from drugs and alcohol for 20 years, and so my relationship with the Downs has changed from that chaotic, insane solace to peace and tranquility and nurturing with the Downs. My children and I moved there, and my husband. I love how he said you go jumping around. It doesn't have to be chronological. I love that. I said, that's probably me.
Yeah.
I moved, when I got out of high school, I traveled the country, crossed the country. I was travveling on the back of the motorcycle to that song, Easy Rider. That's what I thought. But I did travel across the country because I wanted to venture out, and I saw the coastline, California, and I saw the country. I've been up and down on the East Coast because I always, you know, at the time when I was in my turmoil, I was looking for the geographic cure. But I always came back to Rhode Island. And I always found the roots here in Rhode Island. And I always found it by the flow, meaning the Providence River, through the big down went to, my first apartment was across from the old shipyard. And then my other apartments have always been on the flow, on the river, the river, and then the bay. And I lived in Edgewood when I first got married, and I was right on the bay on Arnold's Avenue, right there. My husband and I were looking for a home, and we both felt, and he wasn't from this area. He's a native of Rhode Island, but he was not from this area. We both felt we needed to stay on the bay. And then my home on Landon Road, I never thought I would move back two streets from where I grew up, but we both found that we wanted to stay on the bay and on this on here. So I've tried to travel and thought, maybe am I supposed to live somewhere else? But my heart, my spirit, my grounding, my roots have always been right here, right across from the Downs. And it's very interesting that here I am with my three children. I have one child in Wyman, one in Aldridge, and one in Pilgrim. Right now. And the rituals that we have done down there on New Year's Day, we've done spiritual rituals down there. I try to incorporate with my children all of my life learnings, but sometimes they're ready and sometimes they're not. But it is very, very special place to all of my children. We go down to the break. Oh, and the Rock Island. Oh, what I have done on the Rock Island. We used to visit, you know, 14, bathing in the nude, you know. We thought we were so hot. I mean, you know, all of it has, and I've gotten stuck over there because of the high tide. I couldn't get back. We had to wait.
Me too.
Oh, yeah, we had to wait to come back. You know, I was down in the lanes and all of that. And for me, there's solace there. And there's roots, there's belonging, and this jacket. I had to wear it this evening. I got it in the village, and it's 1800s. And I believe that it was worn by someone who lived in the village, and it's all handmade. And I wore it this evening in honor of the history of the village and of the area. And I'm very, very proud to say that I live on Narragansett Parkway. And when we were younger, we were called Parkway Mondos. We were in the newspaper and everything as Parkway Mondos. So, and I'm very proud of that one too. From South Providence Mondo to the Parkway Mondo. So I'm very, very privileged and honored, and I will always live in Rhode Island. Even when I'm famous and rich, I will always, always live in Rhode Island. And my home right where I live right now is a very small three-bedroom raised ranch. It's very small. I have visions of just expanding it because I love my street. I love every view, the trees. Oh, my God. The trees in this area are history enough. It's amazing to watch the four seasons with the trees because they're hundreds of years old and the trees are comfort to me. One day I looked out my backyard and I have a beautiful oak tree and I said, oh my God, I own an oak tree. I own an oak tree. And it was just like, oh my God. And I just embraced the oak tree and as I embraced the area in which I live in. And to come to this installation, I too came. No one was here, saw my picture over there, heard my voice, woo, it's me, you know, I'm so excited, ooh, it's me. And then to view the exhibit, installation slash exhibit, as I call it, it was just amazing, amazing, and to do it by myself. And the piece that I found is over there on the wall, and I am a very spiritual person, and it's another country, the Mother Mary and Child. And when I found that and gave it to Holly.
That was the treasure when we were doing the cleanup.
Yes.
We found that flyer, and that was her treasure.
And that's what I have found in Warwick Downs is the spirituality and the comfort and the nurturing that we all deserve.
Time.
Thank you.
Very good. Jim, you're right. That's a very nurturing place. We have another speaker, Samnang Yong, and I'm sure he's going to tell us a fish story.
I hope it's not just a fish story. I hope it's a little more exciting than Kim's story. I immigrated to Rhode Island in 1981, grew up in Providence till maybe 9 or 10 years old. Then we moved into Cranston and Edgewood. Not until my senior year in high school, I found about Salter Groves through friends. We decided to go out there one day, just hang out. And I was like, what are they doing? You know, these people fishing on the rocks. I was like, oh, I love fishing. It's like, you know, we just moved here, we're not familiar with the area. So I gotta go fishing. So we left the park, we went to, I think it was like Kmart before, it's like Walmart, you know, took over. Got a fishing pole, and the next weekend we went, my friend and I went fishing after that. And since then, I've been going back to Salter Grove. It's for me, it's also a place. It's where I can collect my thoughts. It's a peaceful place. At different time of days, I go. Sometime early, it's like 5:30 in the morning, to catch the sunrise, and then just stay late at night to see the sunset. The colors, it's just amazing. It's just rich orange, yellow color there. And it's quiet. Then you go in the daytime. During the summertime, there's different group of people that go there. For me, that's also exciting to see. I like the diversity of people just coming together and like meeting and connecting, just talking. But they're all coming from all different areas of the world. So. I don't know if you want to get to the fishing.
We want to hear the fish story.
I usually catch a lot of fish there, and I give it to my friends. But that day, there was something special about it. Nobody was catching anything. We were on the rocks, and maybe 6 or 7 guys out there. And we were just casting nothing. We were all about to leave, like, let's get out of here. All of a sudden, like, this big splash, like right in the cove, just like going, whoosh, whoosh, like, I'm like, oh my God, what is that? And when I caught it, and I was really concerned, I had a 14-pound line, which is for like little fish, you know, just cast for fun. I'm like, how am I gonna get this thing in? It took me pretty much almost over like half an hour. Like I had to like just let it just take it, you know, in, and then like when it's tied, I reel it in, I just keep going back and forth. And then when I finally saw it, I'm like, oh my God. I was like kind of like afraid, and then I felt really bad. I'm like, oh my God, he must be really old, and like been there for like a long time. Like I didn't know what to do, but I wanted to show people that I know that I caught this fish. And I didn't have a camera with me either. Like all I hear in the background is like the guy's like, oh my God, that thing is a monster. Like, where is it? Everybody went in, like, oh, where is it? I got, like, you know, everyone tried to catch one, like that size. Like, I never seen a fish that big either. I'm just like, I didn't know what to do with it. I was like, I don't take it. It took me like another half an hour to get it to shore to where the car is. Because like walking through the rocks, I carry it like this, like I'm dragging it. It's really heavy.
The old man, see.
Yeah, exactly. And like the whole time, like I guess like subconsciously, I'm like worried, like concerned. I'm like, I'm taking like the oldest fish probably in that cold, you know. But like the guy's like, no, you gotta take it. You gotta take it to like this place where they can freeze dry it. And I was like, really? Did you do that? Well, I didn't do that. I was like, I didn't have enough money. It was like about $700 to get it done. I was like, I can't afford that. But it was just something. So I was like, oh, wait, I know Holly. She lives around here. Let me go over to her house. So I just took the fish over. And I'm like, Holly, look at this. And I caught it. I was just like, I don't know, it was an amazing experience for me just to catch something like that.
So Sam, did you have a feast with that
fish? No, I didn't. I usually don't eat the fish. I usually give it to my friends. Or I give it to my sister. Because yeah, because I always keep anything that I catch or kill. So you know, we say like, you know, they don't have any feelings, things like that, but they struggle when you catch it, you know, there's some kind of reaction or emotion to it. So I'd rather like just keep it.
You mean instead of
letting it go back, I don't know if it's
damaged.
Whatever, like yeah, it's
you'd rather
damaged.
Make it personal.
Yeah.
Makes sense. And he feels sorry. Oh. I love that.
Yeah.
No, yeah, that's some.
But that's the history. That's our history as quote unquote primitive peoples. They apologize for the animal. To the animal. We were talking about this early, just like we were talking about ice on the bay. I've never seen ice on the bay, but the so-called primitive peoples—they're sorry that they apologize and thank the animal for being killed. It helps to nourish us. It helps to feed their family. You know, I think that's an important. And he felt the same way. I think there's a very wonderful connection between human, animal, and place. To do that, to acknowledge, to give reverence to that which sustains you, whether it's a fish or whether it's the bay, you know, the same thing. You know? And I've never seen ice on the bay. And I don't think we're going to be seeing it this winter either, because it's like 50.
1991, it was solid. I have pictures of them skating, and I had my sled out there on the bay. You know,
I want to be a part of that.
Oh, yeah, but the bay hasn't, and it hasn't frozen since.
No?
It has, but 1991, it was solid. But nobody else was out there. I was surprised.
That's good, though.
That was a wonderful time in our youth. That was crowded out there.
The magic is for us. You know, the people who see it and appreciate it, it's for us.
That's what Nancy says.
Having been, is it going to be here in 40 years? Right? That it takes 200 years for the water on the surface to go down, recycle, and come back up. So we're not even talking about our own grandchildren. So I'm just curious what each of you might think about how or what or if we should do about it. Right? This fact that, or if that's the right word, you know, that things are going to change, and, you know, it might be nice. I mean, we could have palm trees around here, maybe, I don't know.
Oh.
That'd even be better.
With global warming?
And, well, for example, I mean, so the point is, when I look at photographs of downtown Providence, you know, you see the flood line, the high tide, you know, it's like a half a foot from the water's edge, you know, and that's... Well, it's nice. So I guess awesome. The question I sort of would ask each of you is, what do you think we ought to do?
There's not much we can do. We don't own the park. It's under municipal jurisdiction. There's X amount of stuff that we can do. I'm sure residents have tried to do that and the other thing, and there's always a bureaucratic battle. Should they dredge the cove even more? Should they have put the breakwater up there to begin with? Who knows?
But then we also want to say, and again, this is just here right now as another example, I don't think anything has ever happened, I mean, in my own as well, without a minority doing something. It's never the majority. The majority would...
Yes, go on.
I think...
If you think about it just a little bit, it's too much. And yet,
less is more.
It's always happened that, you know, crazy people, you know, who are Narragansetts maybe or something, you know, have managed somehow to do it. Well, most of us, I would agree with you, don't or can't do anything.
I have a wall down that you could go and swim in. You could go right down and see your feet. I'm not talking about you know, 12 years old. I mean, I'm older than that. It's that really bothers me to think that is what has happened to the place.
place.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear it was at a beach. I can't imagine swimming in that now.
No.
It's gotten much cleaner, though, from the time I...
It is
yeah.
Much cleaner.
Cleaner.
Right.
Yes. Well, go ahead. I don't want to be the one to talk. What do you think? What do we do about this?
I personally, if I'm listening intently to what you said, all I know is I can be a power of example and take care of the land and do the best that I can to help the environment, to preserve the environment and hope that the environment will get cleaner once again.
Just the emissions.
Right. I mean, it's so big, but yet I know that I can start with myself
and
my
family.
And
the oil business and all of that stuff going right by, you know?
For me, that's what I can do because I cannot save the world, but I can save myself and my family.
Mm-hmm.
And be a power of example. In fact, just Sunday, my family and I, we do a prayer meeting, and we talked about what each of us as individuals can do to stop and help change and be part of the 10-year solution that we have. And that includes the Downs, the Bay, and all of that. And that's all I know how to do. I mean, I know how to do more, but I can't get manic.
Right.
Enough is enough.
Have they solved the problems with the sewer plants that are on the river? Have they done much about that with the overflow?
I have no idea.
I think Providence
has. Supposed to be doing that.
Right.
As in Providence.
But that's just going to be another ongoing 10-year project. The only thing is that they're right. In the last few years, things have gotten better. I guess it was the EPA that stopped people from pouring anything they wanted upstream, you know? So I think things are getting better. For example, when I moved to Los Angeles, you could go to the Griffith Park Observatory, and if you were lucky, one day a week, you may see the Pacific Ocean. But through years of EPA regulation and all of this stuff, now it's up to like 3-4 days a week that you can just look to the right and the ocean is there. We don't notice it because we're living in it.
Why is it happening in California?
But it is.
They're now saying all small engines, including lawnmowers, have to have catalytic converters. It's because the people who are elected representatives are doing something.
Right.
And we have to hold their feet to the fire.
Yes.
And say, this is what you have to do, and if you don't do this, we're going to vote against you.
Mm.
You won't be in power anymore.
Right.
I mean, that's about the only direct or indirect power we seem to have.
I read an article in the Journal recently, and it was talking about what's going to be done, and they started naming all the different corporate companies. And someone on this, they took a statement from someone that said, these companies will just say, we've got another research going on. And as long as they keep saying that, they get stuck. So I thought that was interesting. I never heard that before.
Mm-hmm.
Read about that.
Well, in fact, I've heard people say, I'm sure we have here, that they're going to make money fixing. They're just going to wait until it gets bad enough. Do you remember a thing called the Iron Mountain Report? It was published in Esquire maybe 15, 20 years ago.
No.
I'll say it fast. What would we do if we had the moral equivalent of war? Because it's war than in 4 or 5 different categories, like science, technology, culture, blah, blah, has promoted or encouraged or developed stuff. So if we went to permanent peace, what would we have to do? And one of the responses, one of the results, and this panel was formulated under Johnson, I think. So comprising people that knew something at least 2 different fields. Like Pauling was a physicist and he knew something about violence. Anyway, Their position was, we have to find the moral equivalent of war, which means letting things get so bad that we're willing to spend the time and money to fix them. And I've met people who, that's their position, right? That they have control over companies. so they need to have it become enough of a problem so that people will spend the money to do it, focus on it.
Yeah, I think that is the proper answer
to
things.
Yeah, we wonder now, I mean, right here in this place, right, are we coming to this strange position where on the one hand, yeah, well, California has all these great laws, and on the other hand, the Brits are saying by 2040, there won't be any winter ice in the polar regions.
Rock Island will disappear.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, as Henry has said, too, I mean, a lot of the land has, you know, those Green Island used to be much bigger. I mean, he's definitely seen a change. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I was going to say, it's maybe a romantic notion, but I think there's a place for romantic people still in the world. You know, that what David Sobel said, I mean, I think it's important to help children really connect to places in the natural world, which more and more that's harder for them
that's
to do because they're so connected to all these computers and stuff.
People who are older reminisce about when they were kids.
Yeah, well, that's why, and it's really important to have that bonding when you're a kid.
Stop and think about it. We're the last set of people that knows what water really tastes like. All of the water we have is filtered through our pipes. It has this added, it's fluoridated, it's all of this stuff. We remember well water. Tell me which of your kids knows the taste of well water. They know aqua whatever in bottles. They know water in plastic. This is the last. We're the last.
Don't
you know,
say that.
In this area. We are.
I'm with you, Holly. Don't say
no.
that.
But then also, I mean, my kids are, you know, studying, one of my sons is studying about water in science, and I never studied that stuff. I mean, he's much more knowledgeable about, you know, where water comes from and, you know, the various pollutants, and you know, he's just more, and I think that the schools are, you know, trying to address those things much more than when we were growing up. So there's much more of an awareness.
We didn't
obviously.
Worry about the water.
Yeah.
Right.
So they're growing up with, you know.
See, I think that's another curious thing about right here. And even I'm hearing this about Maine. Maine now is a place to be because no one would go there. You know? So somehow Maine now has character that the rest, I mean, Colorado is more like Southern California than it's been Colorado. Mm-hmm. That around here now, Maine is interesting because it's been so backwater, if you're part of the expression, that it now has a character of its own, right? And somehow it was a place where people want to be. And that's part of my hope here, too, is that a place like Pawtuxet or Cranston or Warwick or whatever, right, are so backwater that maybe we have a chance. That the places where money and science are poured into it become polluted. Anyway, that's I'm now speaking. I shouldn't.
It's after 8:30.
Yeah.
But we haven't heard from our friend here about the fish.
Yeah, we did.
Well, I think this project, like, will open like ideas, you know, to different age group, different people. And maybe 10 years from now, like, somebody else will, you know, go to Salter Grove and see whatever they see there and appreciate the same thing and do research and, so, like, you know, and then find out about Holly doing this. You know, it's a little bit of history that for somebody else will continue to do something, like, later on. I think, I don't know what we can do much about global warming, and I don't know how important that will affect so much as Salter Grove. Like, maybe there's other part of the country that is more important. So
Iowa.
But one of the things I'm sorry about this project, I mean, there's just so much I could do, but I would have liked to have connected with the schools more and had kids groups come in here or whatnot. I mean, now that we've done the research and I know all the resources in the community, I mean, I thought, well, now I should just go to Wyman and we should do a project with the kids there because it's right up the street from Salter Grove. And, you know, sort of explore that. So that's a thought. But that's you know, it sort of addresses that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'll sum it. Can I sum it up for you? I want to say that there was a house for sale on Landon Road, and I didn't buy it. No, I'm sorry, I didn't.
Right across the street from me.
Alder Grove, and I wasn't even thinking about knowing it my whole life, and of course, not paid attention to it because it was then right down the street. And this is making me see it with new eyes, and I know you're doing that for other people. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do you want me to write your brief?
We do have some evaluations that if you could please fill them out. And I'm going to put this letter on the back table. I've heard that the Rhode Island Foundation...